Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
From the land of Grand Teton University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 30th day of September 2016. It's USDA Grain Stocks Report Day. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets and the implications of this morning's USDA Grain Stocks Report with Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Aaron Hager, wheat scientist from the U of I, will be here to take up the weeds farmers have been battling all season long and what they can do now to get ready for next year. It's an extended segment, and if you're a producer that's combining soybeans, and know that you've got big weeds and big weed problems, Aaron's got some advice for you. And then, as we close out our time together, we'll look at the agricultural weather forecast right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online at willag.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
On that weather note, I thought it might be interesting to hear up front from Eric Snodgrass a little bit more about the weather in Brazil. Of course, they suffered really dry conditions with El Nino. I wondered whether that had changed much and asked him such.
Yeah, you know, last year's El Nino event really put the northern growing regions, you know, this is like Mato Grosso, into drought. And that drought, of course, persists through their dry season, but they have had a return of rain. Their water storage is coming back up in their soils. And so I'm expecting it to be a pretty decent start to the planting season in the northern growing region. So think Mato Grosso. And because the La Nina is coming in very, very weak, we wouldn't expect the major, you know, problems with yield, heat, and drought in the southern growing regions that we would have seen. So think like Parna in that area. And as a result, I think Brazil could be in for another good year for yields, given that the, you know, the Pacific Ocean's not going to be kind of wreaking havoc on their weather patterns. So something, again, to be watching as we go into the fall and winter here.
That's meteorologist Eric Snodgrass from AgriBull. We'll talk again with him later about the full forecast, including what should be happening over the weekend right here in the Midwest and across the Corn Belt.
Support for agricultural weather on WILL comes from the Friends of WILL and from Busey. With nearly 150 years of agribusiness experience, Busey offers solutions, resources, and expertise to support landowners. Busey, your dream, our promise.
Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really, thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklevic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzulum. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news. Oh, and thank you. Thank you so much for listening.
This stock and commodity report is made possible with support of the Friends of WILL and Bates Commodities in Normal. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647. Or on the internet at batescom.net.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Friday afternoon. It's the 30th day of September. I'm away from the office. No worries. Mike Zuzlo is here. He's from Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Mike, thank you so much for being with us today. Tell me a little bit about the USDA report this morning, the implications on the trade in Chicago, and how things finished up, please.
Start with the quarterly grain stocks and small grains reports, and then we'll get to the closing markets. Mid-session USDA came out with all wheat production. We'll start there with the small grains, 2.309 billion bushels. That was a bit below the average trade guess, about 20 million bushels below the average trade guess. Spring wheat planted acres came in at 11.6 million planted for 2016. That was about a 4.4% reduction in planted acres versus their previous estimate, and that's going to be down a little over 13% from last year. We'll talk about the closing, but the spring wheat did have a better closing this week and had a nice recovery as we closed out today. On to the grain stocks report, all wheat, September 1 stocks, 2.527 billion bushels, higher than the trade guess. Average number was 2.4 billion. Corn stocks, September 1, 1.737 billion. Average trade guess, 1.75. So we came in below the average trade guess in corn. Soybeans at 197 million bushels as of September 1, also below the average trade guess of a little over 200 million. Now, as we look at September 1 stocks versus last year, both corn and beans are only 6 million bushels higher than they were a year ago in stocks. I think that was a supportive number for both, and I think the trade probably saw it that way as well. For the wheat, not so much. 430 million more bushels than we had a year ago, the most since 1987. We noticed that wheat was the dragging factor in the sell side of the spreads as we got into the post-report time period until the close when the spring wheat came around. On farm totals, a pretty important number. Corn came in at 36% of the total stocks. As far as what farmers are holding, that is up a little bit versus last year. However, beans came in at 21% that farmers were holding right now versus 26% a year ago. So we have seen farmers move more beans, and that makes sense. Wheat at 29% on farm of the total compares to 31% last year. So post-report, December corn was able to make new weekly highs thanks to the stocks report. The December wheat made in the soft red complex new monthly lows thanks to mainly the production report and also the fact that we had that higher 2.53 billion bushel grain stocks number. So how we closed up, corn up 7.5 in the December, 336 and three quarters. November beans up 3.75 at 954. And the December wheat in the soft red up 3 cents at 402. We did see October meal finish steady at 297.90 on Friday's close. That was beneficial given all the anti-dumping duty news that we got from the DDGs and the Chinese. And I would say also not a bad close in the corn market given the fact that we have fresh talk in the markets that corn will be exported out of China in the not-too-distant future. That out before the opening this morning. Back to the prices, spring wheat was actually up 4.75 of a penny in the December contract, 5.125. Meanwhile, in the hard red wheat, down 2 cents at 4.15 1/4. The oats up 2.25 in December at 1.78 1/4. Over in the livestock markets, very big hit to the markets, led by the hogs. Quarterly hogs and pigs report just now coming out. We were down over 5% in October hogs, down to 49.02. That would be down $2.70. Next support line is the October 2009 lows. With the hogs leading, cattle and feeders both closed down limit, so we'll have expanded limits of $4.50 in the fat cattle on Monday's trade, down 3 cents or $3.00 in the October fats at 98.90. December fats down limit also at $100.12. Feeders down $4.50, October closing at 123.15. The December dollar index down about 10 at 9.95.37. The November light crude oil in the West Texas Intermediate New York market up 27 cents at 48.10. and that in large part due to Russia and the OPEC commentary talking about a production cap this week. So that was a very beneficial macro development that should support the soy complex, especially as we get into next week's trade, especially if we have any further harvest delays, which is possible based upon some of the models, especially the European model, from what we can tell, is running a bit wetter, especially as we get towards midweek, Thursday, Friday, specifically for Illinois. Bond markets down 108 at 168.12. The stock market's having a nice recovery. S&P's up 20. The Dow Jones is up about 183 right now, currently trading 18.280 in lead month futures. Gold is down slightly. Silver is up about 3 ticks. Other than that, going back to the report, and as we finish out the closing market commentary, I think we're still on track for that 2014-type market playing out, i.e. a low as we finish out this quarter today. I'd like to see the technicals help us, especially given that fresh trade talk about Chinese exports maybe coming in on the corn market. This is Mike Suslow, Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Atchison, Kansas. Have a good weekend, everyone.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're now joined by Extension weed scientist Aaron Hager from here on the Urbana-Champaign campus as I've driven around the state of Illinois this year. Aaron, soybean fields look like those of the 1970s, meaning there are just weeds in the soybean fields. We haven't seen that really since, I don't know, the mid-1990s when Roundup first came into being. It's ugly, and I know farmers are going to want to know what they can do next year.
I guess if there was ever a year where you would almost conclude that in many of these field situations, like you described, as the wheels fell off the bus, it's this year. I think without a doubt, as I've traveled around the state, the frequency of seeing soybean fields especially, but not restricted only to soybean, we occasionally see this in corn also, but the dense populations of weeds that are overtopping soybeans is absolutely tremendous. It's more common this year than I think I've ever seen it in all the 23 years that I've been here at the University of Illinois.
Is it as common in conventional tillage as it is in no-till?
I would have to say, depending on the species, the answer can be yes. Water hemp, from what we have seen around the state, really hasn't discriminated too much between either tillage or no tillage. In other geographies in the state of Illinois, especially no-till soybean, the amount of mare's tail or horseweed that still exists in these fields, areas I've been in northwestern Illinois, it's almost difficult to see the soybean for all the mare's tail that's overtopped the soybean canopy.
Would that be the first year they really had to deal with the mare's tail in this form?
It's hard to tell for sure. It's unlikely that this all just erupted in one year. Usually there's a gradual buildup in terms of a few escapes one year leading seed into the seed bank for subsequent years. But in that particular geography of the state, I don't ever recall seeing the mare's tail density or the populations at levels that they are this year.
I'm fairly certain that at least with mare's tail, there is a fall application of sorts that you'd like them to do in order to make sure it's controlled.
Usually in the northern, let's say two-thirds of Illinois, a pretty high percentage or proportion of the total mare's tail emergence in a calendar year does occur in the fall of the year. And certainly after crop harvest, we usually will have a pretty good window of opportunity to try to do a fall application. The simple fact of the matter is that we suspect that most of this mare's tail that has escaped is likely resistant to glyphosate, which is a very significant component of many of the burn down herbicide programs in the spring. So our fall recommendation typically for mare's tail is that if we're somewhere in the October to November time frame, these fall applications targeting mare's tail can be as simple and as inexpensive as say a quart of 2,4-D ester product. It's very effective against the small plants. We can actually use the appropriate rate that we need to for mare's tail, because a quart of 2,4-D ester in the fall will always perform much, much better than a pint of 2,4-D ester in the spring, especially considering that typically in the spring, the plants are going to be much larger.
How about the other weeds? What do we do, if anything?
The water hemp situation, Todd, it continues to escalate in terms of the frequency of resistance. I think probably in most cases, when we look at fields and the only weed that we see in the fields that still exists is water hemp, pretty good indication, at least anecdotal observations, that it's probably resistant to at least one, if not more, herbicides. The frequency of multiple resistance in these populations, in these individual plants, continues to go up. It's getting a little bit difficult to actually find water hemp plants now that are resistant to only two herbicides. Three is exceptionally common. We've actually documented resistance now in individual plants to herbicides from four side of action groups. And we've got a population close by here that's actually now evolved resistance to herbicides from five different side of action groups.
What's in the pipeline? What will be approved?
With respect to some of the trait technologies, the Roundup Extend system did receive the European import approval for the grain, so that hurdle has been overcome. However, as we speak today, there has been no federally approved label for any dicamba-containing product to be applied post-emergence to those soybeans. So as of right now, we cannot recommend that simply because there's no label for that product to be used in that system. A lot of people are asking, will there be one in place for next year? And we really don't know. I received a correspondence from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency about a month ago. I'd never had one from the EPA like this before. But in essence, what this memo said was that the EPA was very aware of what had happened in areas of, say, the Boot Hill of Missouri, areas of certain areas of Arkansas and western Tennessee, where very likely that farmers had illegally applied a dicamba-containing herbicide to these varieties that they had elected to plant this year. And one note in that memo said that EPA is aware of this, what has happened, and it will factor into their decision when or if they decide to grant a label for these products.
Yeah, so they were expected to make a decision during the summer months. That hasn't happened. I think they're suggesting maybe by the end of the year at this point. However, they're really concerned about what farmers have done with the dicamba products on soybeans, and the concern stretches not just because farmers did it, but because of the wide swath that it takes, if I remember right, in some of the extenuating circumstances surrounding the fields, mm-hmm. not just on the fields.
It's, you can't escape the fact that of all the plant species that are known to grow in the state of Illinois, one of the most sensitive to dicamba is soybean. It always has been, it always will be. Our concern, of course, is with the exposure of a non-dicamba soybean to dicamba can happen in myriad ways. It always has when dicamba was used exclusively or near exclusively in corn. I go back to an article that I wrote for our bulletin probably 20 years ago where I referenced the fact that at that time, at that era, that the most common soybean injury symptom that we would see year in and year out was leaf cupping caused by exposure to dicamba. There's very, very few other things that will cause a soybean leaf to assume this shape in terms of its growth. The problem, of course, always comes down to identifying how the dicamba exposure took place. It's very, very unlikely, even if a dicamba-containing product is approved for use in 2017, it's very, very unlikely that we will have complete adoption of those varieties. It won't happen in 2017, and who knows? It's very unlikely that we will have 100% adoption of dicamba-resistant soybean in the state of Illinois ever. So there will always be some percentage of our soybeans that would remain sensitive to dicamba.
And availability of these seed traits, probably not all that high, I would think, yet.
I think a lot of it will hinge upon when or if a label is granted. We've heard estimates that of certain numbers of units or acres that would be planted to it if a label is generated or granted by EPA, and quite a bit of reduction in that number if no label is granted.
Any other products that can be used to control water hemp?
Well, certainly, you know, we look a couple of the other trait platforms, the Enlist system from Dow AgriSciences. The label is in place, however, they still lack the Chinese import approval for the seed. And they've indicated to us that it's very unlikely that they're going to try to bring a lot of that trait technology to the market until they have that Chinese approval. So the other platform that is fully available, fully registered, and has all clearances and import approval is the LibertyLink soybean system. And I think a lot of farmers who tried that system this year have been fairly pleased with the results, especially compared with maybe neighbors who elected to try, you know, the glyphosate resistant system for one more time and ended up being a pretty much overgrown weedy mess of things like water hemp or maresteel. It's a viable system. It can work. However, we've not seen any resistance to glufosinate in our broadleaf species that we encounter in the Midwest, and we'd really like to keep it that way. And so there are certain things that farmers could consider doing with a glufosinate resistant or LibertyLink soybean system to try to further reduce the likelihood that we would evolve resistance to that herbicide. I mean, the simple fact is there's very, very few experimental herbicides under development right now, and we're very unlikely to see anything that's new and novel, you know, within the next 5 to 10 years.
Any suggestions then?
Well, the suggestion simply would be we're going to have to think about how do we better manage these weed populations instead of simply trying to find another jug to open up and throw it in the tank. We're rapidly depleting the options. When you've evolved resistance now in one weed species to herbicides from 6 different site of action families, and we can find all 6 within the borders of Illinois, there's not that many more options that we've got. So we've got to really be careful and steward what we have right now. If you've got a water hemp population that still remains sensitive to a particular herbicide, you know, we highly and strongly encourage people to do everything that they can to make sure that that sensitivity continues.
Do you have concerns, different topic, about the consolidation of the industry so that we'll go from 6 to 3 now that we've got Bayer and Monsanto?
I guess in that merger, maybe not so much from a herbicide standpoint, since Monsanto, they quit being a herbicide company years and years ago. Bayer still has a very active development program based primarily out of Germany. You know, the Dow, the DuPont, there would be an example of a merger of two companies that still maintained, you know, herbicide discovery efforts. So when those are put together, sometimes you can, I would assume in the business world, sometimes there's good synergies that come from those mergers. Other times, you know, you may sit back and say, well, there's one less primary manufacturer now than what we had even a year or so back.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. You bet.
Aaron Hager is an extension weed scientist for University of Illinois, located here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. I'm Todd Gleason. It's a Friday afternoon, the 30th day of September. Find us online at willag.org. There you can listen to our programming anytime you'd like, on demand. In just a few moments, we'll return. We'll talk about the agricultural weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass. He's from Agrible, right here in Urbana-Champaign.
It's National Mulled Cider Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1861, William Wrigley Jr. was born. An American salesman and manufacturer, he started out as a traveling salesman at the age of 13, selling soap for his father's company. At age 30, he left his father's soap factory and moved to Chicago, where he began manufacturing soap and including free baking powder as an incentive. When baking powder proved more popular than soap, he switched to offering baking powder with chewing gum as an incentive. And then you guessed it, the chewing gum proved widely popular, and Wrigley's Chewing Gum was born. In 1958, pie plates being sailed around among employees at the Frisbee Baking Company at Yale University became the inspiration for the Whammo Standby. In 1962, the United Farm Workers Union was founded by Cesar Chavez. And in 2004, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed into law a bill that bans the production and sale of foie gras. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Friday afternoon. Eric Snodgrass is here. He's from Agribull to talk about the weather forecast. Eric, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you define something for me? I'd like to know what a cutoff low is and how that's interpreted into the coming weather forecast.
Yeah, you know, this is a great question and one that I want everybody that's listening right now to understand, because we talk about it all the time in meteorology. So we have this flow in the atmosphere, this flow at the jet stream level. So this is maybe 5-6 miles above our heads. And where we live on the planet, we have basically a flow that comes from the west. We're in the westerly wind belt. Well, occasionally that flow will kind of turn to the north and then dip to the south. And those northward turns are called ridges, and those southward turns are called troughs. Sometimes, just like a river does, you can kind of pinch off a bit of that flow and just let it sit there and spin. And that's basically what a cutoff low is. It's where we have this area of troughing in the jet stream where we've basically pinched off a portion of the jet stream, and it kind of spins while the rest of the jet stream flows right past it. And the problem is when that happens, that pattern, that weather pattern just gets stuck and it stays put. And that's what we've been in for most of this past week, and we're still in today. That cutoff low has been sitting over the Midwest, over the Great Lakes, and with it we have the cooler temperatures, much cooler temperatures, but we keep having these bands of showers that kind of wrap around that cutoff low, you know, really keeping things kind of damp in some locations and really kind of cooler than this time of year should normally be. And so here's the thing, that cutoff low finally gets pushed by the jet stream behind it off to the East Coast by the end of the weekend. And the next week, we build into a bit of a warm-up again. Now, remember, our average high temperatures here in central Illinois this time of year should be right around that 70-degree mark. So this warm-up, if it's 5, 6, 7 degrees above average, takes us back up into the upper 70s, maybe even the lower 80s. But this is not going to be like the heat we saw, you know, more than a week ago. And I'll tell you this, Todd, that warmer weather doesn't seem to last too long. Latest model projections bring in another shot of cooler air that comes in around October 7th, 8th time frame and knocks our temperatures back down again. So this is the time of year where we have to pay close attention to that jet stream and its flow patterns.
And then if you could take a moment and talk about standing water for me and how you view it. There are some problems still in Iowa.
Yeah, so Iowa had some incredibly heavy rains, as did parts of Minnesota and Wisconsin more than a week ago. And I'm seeing a lot of pictures coming across some of the folks I follow on the internet saying, we still have standing water in some fields. And even in Indiana, they've gotten some really heavy rains from this cutoff low recently. So there's some problems getting this crop out of the field right now.
Tell me a little bit about Tropical Storm Matthew.
Matthew has been one we've been watching now for well over a week, and it has a lot of uncertainty in its future track, and it could most certainly impact agriculture. Right now, Matthew is on the verge of becoming a hurricane, but I'll tell you, there's so much uncertainty in the track of Matthew that there is still the possibility that it might enter the Gulf of Mexico rather than going up the East Coast of the United States. So big, you know, kind of picture ag impacts is mainly from cotton and peanuts. So think about those crops that are grown there right along, you know, kind of in North and South Carolina, parts of Georgia, up into Virginia. You know, if we push that moisture right up into that region from what will eventually become Hurricane Matthew, boy, it could really impact the peanut harvest and the cotton harvest. So we got to keep our eye on the tropics this time of year. And Matthew is certainly the one to be watching over the next several days.
Hey, thanks, Eric. Eric Snodgrass is with Agrible from right here in Urbana.